Hi, this is Josh Banner, and you're listening to The Invitation.
Was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. being realistic when he gave that iconic speech? You know, I have a dream. Is that being realistic? Or is that the greater realism that we need to live into? Do we have a capacity as human beings, made in the image of God, to envision and imagine the future? And silence is that place where that can happen. I think in some sense it can only happen without the noise that are constantly vying for attention. If in that space, whether it be a small desk of a poet, or a studio, or a kitchen, or a garage, it's necessary for our being, for us to grow, for us to find that integration between the spirit and the body.
These are the words of painter, author, an art advocate, Makoto Fujimura, from a conversation I had with him on November 13, back in 2017. From my viewpoint, Makoto is the most well-known visual artist today who engages his faith in a public conversation. There's plenty of evidence to believe that. In the sense that his paintings have been featured in galleries and museums around the world. He's collaborated extensively with other painters, musicians, authors, and filmmakers. In 2003, Makoto was appointed by the president to the National Council on the Arts. At the time of this conversation in 2017, Mako was the vision director of Fuller Theological Seminary's Brehm Center, where he collaborated with my friend David Taylor, who is currently an associate professor of theology and culture at Fuller. David appeared back in episode 42, and he is responsible for my access to be able to sit down with Makoto. So big thanks to David Taylor for making not just this connection, but several connections for me over the years. Much love to you, brother. Makoto has written a collection of books on art and faith. He is the founder and animator of the International Arts Movement. And in this episode, he and I talk about his book, Silence and Beauty, which is a written account of his personal experience, faith journey, through reading Shusaku Endo's much celebrated novel, Silence. And in my mind, in the backdrop of this conversation with Makoto, I was understanding that he had been consulting Martin Scorsese in his film adaptation of the novel, Silence. So even in understanding the significance of Makoto Fujimura's many accomplishments and distinctions, what is the compelling substance of his work? I'm going to include in the show notes a link to a short video on how Makoto came to faith through his art form, through Nihonga, which is the ancient Japanese style of painting that he is trained in and that he practices. What I want to offer for your consideration is that we are drawn to Makoto Fujimura and his painting because he is a worldly mystic. What do I mean by a worldly mystic? Well, let me explain this by inviting you to back up with me and to see the larger picture. This particular podcast episode is the fourth of a series of conversations that move in and between the arts and faith, between culture and prayer. What is it that we're doing here on the Invitation Podcast? We're gathering around prayers, meditations, and spiritual conversations to work out our faith in fear and trembling as we are being renewed into the image of Christ as human beings fully alive. So that comes from the Invitation's mission, which I've borrowed the vocabulary of St. Irenaeus from the 2nd century, where he defines that the glory of God is a human being fully alive. So in these conversations, when I gather with others to document some discussion that I would want to share with you, we are attempting to attend to how we're made in the image of God between our spiritual and our physical beings. This is what I mean by a worldly mystic when I speak of Makoto. This is a human being who is at the intersection of contemplation and justice. This is to live between our spiritual and our physical realities. As Makoto describes it here in this conversation, this is to become integrated. So Mako's work is luminous, and on one hand, it's very spiritual. He incorporates ethereal visions of colors and textures, yet if you consider how his paintings are made, and if you're able to be physically present with his paintings, which are stretched on large canvases, you'll get a sense of the very earthy, bodily, physical nature of his work. I believe we're drawn to Makoto Fujimura's work because it casts a vision that reminds us that we have access to something more sacred, more loving, more hopeful, more beautiful and wonderful in our present lives than we can immediately ask or imagine. So in this discussion, what I hope you can hear is that there is a parallel between the person of craft, of art, and the person who attends to prayer. So whether you are artistically inclined or not, you are created by God to be creative. And our primary vocation as human beings fully alive is to somehow become attentively cooperative with the Holy Spirit, so we can, in the language of Acts 17, live and move and have our creative beings in God. I hope and pray that as you listen to Makoto Fujimura, you'll catch a glimpse of who the Spirit is inviting you to become as a human being fully alive. I'm rolling here, so I just want to welcome Makoto Fujimura to the Invitation Podcast. I can't say what a treat and delight it is to have you with me here.
It's great to be here.
My wife's office, I share somewhat. So, you know, from the conversations I've been around with you here, your trips to Calvin College and then here at Hope, you struck me as a man who doesn't just talk about art. And I've noticed, as I've been refreshing myself with some of the language around your artistry, a person who appreciates silence, talking about engaging your paintings as a contemplative act.
Yes.
So can you talk a bit about your history? I know you came to faith through your art, practice. Yeah, yeah. So can you give us a little snippet, glimpse into that?
Ever since I can remember, when I created something, I felt something go through me. Mm. And so I've always felt that art was a gift of some kind. I didn't know who was the source of this, but you know, as T.S. Eliot said, at the end of the longest river, I found Christ, and ever since then, it was very clear for me what I was doing in this world and why I. It took me a while to realize that art was a gift, this gratuitous gift that will continue to feed me, nourish me, but that my role in the world was to simply be myself, as fully authentic as I can be, to not wear the false mask of ego, but to find my identity hidden in Christ. And once that kind of sorted itself out, I never had any doubt about what I was to do. And so everything I do, even these lectures that I have been doing, mentoring or any kind of leadership I give, flows out of that studio experience. It is sacred, and it's where I am most myself, and when I hear God and experience God's presence. Mm.
So you had an experience of something that you couldn't put a name to before you came to Christ?
Exactly. So I call my journey of faith, I started out in inversion rather than conversion, because I always felt God's presence. I felt alienated from that at times, but I never thought of art as anything but the spiritual connection. Mm. Yeah.
So were you born in Japan?
I was born in Boston.
Okay.
My father is a research scientist, and then we went to Sweden and then to Japan. I went to grade school in Japan, so I consider that to be my earliest identification with a place. But I still, to this day, I feel a bit nomadic, and my farm in Princeton is where I find myself at home. And but I recently have been working with Fuller Seminary and at the Bram Center as a director. So I end up doing that, being in Pasadena 4 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. But I feel always nomadic and not quite sure where my home is. And that may be why, being in a studio, I have two studios now, one in Princeton, one in Pasadena, but that allows me to center my being, and I'm able to locate myself through my work. Mm.
That language of centering your being is really special to me. And so thinking about that as an artist, mm-hmm. and then as a person of prayer and spirituality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you've always had the sense that these two were integrated before you came to the church.
Yeah. And I think I struggled when I entered the church to validate that instinct. And which is strange to say, because you'd think finding your identity as a Christian will lead to discovering your identity in Christ. Mm. But that is not necessarily the case. And so I had to sort through all that, not understanding initially, like how I were to integrate my faith and my being. When it seems to me that when I was even a child creating, I felt this delight, and I now know that was coming from God, and God is the artist, and is inviting His little children to co-create with Him. I think that to me is the most important facet of what I do as an artist, and in some ways this is what I wish for other Christians to have. Mm.
And what I've been reading about in terms of epistemological therapy,
yes,
art as yes. A therapeutic healing.
Yes.
That there's something about the imagination, creativity that can leap over some lack that we're experiencing in the church.
Yeah, these false dichotomies mm-hmm. we create. And unfortunately, that's in the world and the way we think. So you do need a deep therapy mm-hmm. to unlock that. And art does do that. They're very naturally we enter a generative domain that move beyond categories and will in some cases collapse some unnecessary ones and create new ones. So that's just much an importance of why artists are needed in the world is because we tend to be integrated to begin with, mm-hmm. and it's really our ego that forces us to wear a mask and separate our public identity with the private one. To have that joy, your first love, be denied by whatever it is that we're seeking after, kind of this resume building mm-hmm. thing that we do. And but to me, my art, while I'm very ambitious in what I attempt to do, my art was never part of that kind of resume building mm-hmm. or success in worldly terms. Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me an offering and mm-hmm. gift first to God. And if I'm in the marketplace, you have to think about that side of it. But mm-hmm. but nevertheless, you put it back, to the sacred domain, mm-hmm. That seems to be the only way that artists can exist in the world without sacrificing your soul mm. to the process. Mm.
So the big 50-cent word of epistemology, I want to add phenomenology
yes.
to this. So epistemology is the way that we know how we know, and
yes.
then phenomenology would be the experience
yes.
of what we know, or experience of ontology,
yes.
if you want to add another word. And you've written and talked about the ontology of,
yes.
of art as a being present. So what I'm trying to do with this podcast is to help people become as practical and as experiential
wow.
with the
mm-hmm.
presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so the ironic thing for me is that I was the worship minister here for 8 years and oversaw the recording studios. That's why I've got these microphones here and
yes.
made music. And then I burned out and I got into the spiritual direction world
sure.
and thought that I was done with creativity in that way that I'd known. And I'm thrilled to have this conversation with you because it's, for me, an integration of bringing things back
together.
Around.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so there's many ways we can go at this. But in terms of the actual experience, so you had this sense before you came to the church that there's something more that was happening through your materials.
Mm-hmm.
And I've rehearsed, your awe of just pigment
yeah.
and the basic fundamental parts of your craft as a painter.
Right.
So what is actually, if you can remember back, and then even maybe painting you've been doing recently, what practically really is happening, the phenomenology?
Yes, of all of that, Well, the sensory input or experiential realm is absolutely overwhelming to an artist. We see way more than what we can handle. And so, you know, before I came to know Christ, I think it was a case in which there was a suspended way that he had to handle everything, including your faith in communication, your faith in the world, your faith in reality, all of that is contested. But you know, what happened was when things aligned, and I saw Christ as the eminent presence of the universe, who was and is and is to come. All that became, you know, not superfluous, but it became less important, that I could simply be a child of God and to play as the artist father is playing, to create in gratuity and excess, all that is beautiful. And that God created our senses to receive that. So what seems to be superfluous and excess and extravagant becomes a signpost of God's presence in our lives. And we keep running away from it. Technology and modern conditions force us to truncate that experience. Survival mechanism kicks in, and we begin to lose ourselves in that journey. So for me, it really is that recovery of faith is the substance of things hoped for. The recovery of hope is what I do as an artist. And the phenomenological reality of that is that I'm facing these beautiful pigments that have faces behind it, meaning that these were pulverized by people that I know in Japan who know my work and who love my work and care for me as an artist. I know the paper makers and I know the brush makers and I know the people who invested literally generations of time and energy so that I can work. And so it's an ecosystem of collaboration, and I'm just grateful that I get to do this. And there's this sensory thrill of sheer beauty that these materials present themselves, and that I am a steward of this immense sacrifice that went into making of these materials, and the ages, the eons of time that is represented by these pulverized minerals, and so it's not too difficult to locate myself in that generous sphere of gratitude, so I see what I do as this moment in time when perhaps all these elements come together in a single moment, and it just seems so magical to me. And so every time I paint, I sense that.
One of the texts that I use in a course is The Gospel as Comedy, Tragedy, and Fairy Tale by Frederick Buechner. And so what I hear you saying is that the actual coming together is this excess, is like this fairyland, this fantasy, this is beyond anything we could ever ask or imagine. And so you as the artist seeing possibilities and then being able to steward that.
Yes.
And yes. Give thanks for all of the people that have come together for this moment.
Yes, yes.
And so the freedom of the creative act, the extravagance of that is a kind of praise and thankfulness.
Yeah, and you know, in old medieval language, the gospel is God spell. Mm-hmm. You know, it is instead of being cast a you know, evil spell by people, we cast this good spell and to liberate people from the bondage to decay. And there's a sense in which art, music, theater, dance is a conduit for doing that, releasing people. And I sense that to my own life when I'm working. And you know, art can also be hard, and it can be any kind of craft is difficult to master. And but really, when you sense that freedom in whether it be going to a museum or listening to a concert or and taking it in, that is a invitation to journey into perhaps every one of us finding that voice and being able to be makers again, you know, to not just consumers, you know, but be makers. And I think that perhaps is the most integrated way to form spiritually. That spiritual formation is not just being able to read books or, you know, sitting still or the prayer and all that, yes. But even in prayer, even in worship, even in praise, there is the making part. And I would love to see that integrated. And every person, whether you're a professional artist like myself or not, be able to tap into that integrated zone that God has given us through the God spell that, you know, both liberates us but also integrates us.
Thank you. So I wanted to, another little background question. I've got so many questions. So your form, your tradition is pronounced Nihonga?
Nihonga, yes.
So this last summer I had had a invitation to do a public lecture on beauty I added prayer because that's my zone right now. And so my wife and I are actually teaching a course right now, first year seminar, a seminar on beauty and prayer.
Wow.
And so I used the prep for this public lecture as a way to create this course. And and I was sitting down thinking about, well, what do I really believe the resonance is between beauty and prayer?
Yeah.
And when I was thinking about beauty, what do I find beautiful? Yes. Out of nowhere, in my imagination, in my memory, I remembered this picture of a wave.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the stylizing, and I was like, no, that must be Japanese.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, the great wave of Kanazawa came to mind, did a little research into ukiyo-e.
Yeah.
And then this book that I've just shared with you has a poem, as I started talking with my wife, where she is looking at ukiyo-e.
Yeah.
And comparing it to the paintings of Degas.
Yes.
And so there was this sense that beauty is that kind of generative, as you've used before, where it calls out to us. There's something attractive about it that calls us deeper into more.
Yes.
And leads us on a journey.
Yes.
So is that seems to be resonating with what I've been recollecting of your definitions of beauty.
Yeah, so great art is generative in that it gives birth continuity as the viewer encounters with their own experiences and their own journeys. And art that endures tend to be very expansive that way. And so depending on the age, you know, what is happening in the world, it takes to take on more and more. And that's, you can't really explain what that is, other than to say that perhaps it is connected to this greater reality that God has created. And because that in itself is generative and expansive, and artists are the ones that intuit that into form, using words or paint or body movements or film, you know, that happens to be where we are made, and we resonate with when things line up.
So, to add some more tactile, tangible, the difference for you, like from what you know about ukiyo-e and then your own tradition,
right,
of Nihonga, what was it about Nihonga that drew you out of all the Japanese possibilities? You could have picked Western influences.
Yeah, there was this fittingness that I felt, the immediacy that I felt as a student encountering Nihonga materials. You know, ukiyo-e wood blocks are part of that tradition, and what Van Gogh and all these impressionists were influenced by very directly. But to me, that flow of Japanese aesthetics into the world met me back in Japan, and rediscovery of 16th century and 17th century work that led to the refinement of Japanese aesthetics, especially in 17th century. And so that was designed without me being aware of that, but I continue to find myself, in my recent book, Silence and Beauty, as I was writing on Shusaku Endo's masterpiece, Silence, came out in the 60s, that continue to be generative in the world, to capture the imagination of modern Scorsese and to have this pregnant ways that
it's like
it has
25 years.
Journeyed with 20, almost 30 years. And it has affected his life, you know, and his trajectory as a filmmaker and as a person. And I think that is the proper response to any work of art, is that the work of art beckons us, invites us to make something. That's the proper response, you know, that we are inspired and it goes out back into the world in some other way, and that it is ultimately a gift that operates, should operate in a way outside of the market economy. Because we will always reduce something to market something, and you know, that's an important reality that we need to understand. That's why we need to loop out of our consumer mentality and become makers again.
So, do you think that Nihonga, as a style, as a tradition of painting, has particular ways of fighting the boundaries, the consumerism?
Well, it is slow. If you want to create an image, you know, there's much easier way of creating digitally, and so it fights against that tendency of reductionism and virtual reality, and yet it is profoundly attractive, I think, to this age in which we have learned to not to see deeply, and human beings can't live too long in that world. We realize something is wrong, something is off. And you know, I have my iPhone and you know, iPad and all that too. But they are tools, and you have to, just like any other tool, you have to cultivate your vision to use them. And so that means, going back to phenomenological reality, that means human touch, that means seeing things and sitting in front of a Rothko painting for an hour, you know, this sense of going to see live theater, not be satisfied with, you know, 2 hours in the movie theater, but make a theater, you know, movie. I think those things go back to the physical incarnation, manifestation of something into the world, which is the hardest part. And I think we need to, even more today, cultivate that.
Yeah, I part of the tacit purpose of an invitation podcast is really answering the lack of what we're missing, and I hear you returning to this in a very generous way. There's a lot of people in our culture, especially in the church, that want to just be grumpy about what people are doing wrong.
right.
And, sure. But how to do this winsomely, to call people to more of God, more of themselves,
more
of creation.
Yeah.
So I hear that with you. And part of what I'm, what I'm hearing in terms of Nihonga and just your presence, your way of approaching these things, if I could offer a vocabulary of the apophatic vis-a-vis the cataphatic.
Yes.
So we have all of this great doctrine that's been handed down. We have lots of orthodoxy. My concern is orthopraxy or or doxology, worship and practice. And so what would you say about that in the sense of your studying? There's like, there's language like mysticism. There's language like the, I saw it in some of the engagement, the via negativa. How do you think about those things in terms of art making?
It's all about the process, you know. That's the most important part. And I think we have been so obsessed by formula and this plastic formulation that we lost touch with the mystery of our own being, and that can only be discovered when we allow the mystery of God and the mystery of the gospel to invade what we think is sound and safe. And life will do that no matter what, but how we receive that becomes a huge path toward either growth or regression. And, you know, and we sometimes we have to regress to go forward, but so it's not what it seems, you know. You have to be biased toward God's goodness that's operating in the world, and we can certainly be cynical and you know, complain all day, but that's not generative. You know, a proper critique is necessary. That is surely part of art. But what is generative is creating Genesis moments that is at hand. Every moment is a Genesis moment, and we will do well to observe, to receive that, and as an opportunity for for our own journey, and God helps us through His Spirit to be more fully aware, to be fully present, to be alive in that moment when we feel that there's chaos and darkness creeping in.
Is the voice of reason, the Western empirical modernist utilitarian sense would say, you know, Marco, you know, let's just get practical here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you're, sure. This painting, I don't really know what your painting's about.
Yeah.
And your Japanese culture is great and everything, but eventually we need to make some money.
Yes.
And and in the religious spiritual context, it would be like, well, what's the truth? Like, can you give me some Bible lessons here? But you seem to be saying, well, it's actually the mystery that helps me be the most generative.
That's right. And practical.
And practical.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I've heard so many times as an artist, people saying, well, be realistic. You know, imagination is treated as suspect. You know, we say, you know, you're imagining things. So, you know, and yet when we think about the things that endure, the most important things that we treasure, this is, you know, everybody, not just artists. We come down to these experiences that cannot be reduced, that cannot be marketed, that cannot be something that we can even describe. And so when people say, well, be realistic, what do they mean? Because was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. being realistic when he gave that iconic speech? You know, I have a dream. Is that being realistic? Or is that the greater realism that we need to live into? Do we have a capacity as human beings made in the image of God to envision and imagine the future? And does God say, you stupid little creatures, you know, you're just imagining things? Or is God in some fundamental way affirming that through His own imagination and His own sacrifice? So being realistic hasn't gotten us anywhere. But being these creatures of imagination has literally reshaped the future. And that is also the other way. You know, we have created atomic weapons by using our capacity to imagine as well. So both the destruction and the generative possibilities are literally vying for our future, and that's why art is so important, because unless we train our imagination to take flight into the future, we can all become terrorists and train our imaginations to destroy lives rather than to rebuild or even give life to many. And so that seems to me, I used to just, you know, accept that the world is pragmatic and utility driven and, you know, wants efficiency and production rather than creation. But I don't know, I can't, I've gotten to a place where I'm like, you know, I don't think that's really good for us. That's not what I want my children and my grandchildren to hear. You know, I understand people saying that, but they're saying that out of fear or some kind of wound that they have received. And it's time to, you know, get out of it and at least understand that we need to speak with generosity and speak into a future that is generative.
this morning I was meeting with a directee, and she was recounting to me a story of having an experience of God's reality that was so healing to her.
Yeah.
And she was referring to it as something that happened a couple weeks ago. And so we sat and pondering, what if that experience is not done? And so we went back and used our imagination to recollect that experience.
Yeah.
Where was it that God was moving inside of you?
Yes.
And is it possible that that place that God touched you and spoke to you and healed you is the same God that's with us in this room right now?
Yes.
And so likewise, if someone spends time with Four Quartets, T.S. Eliot, or Makoto Fujimura painting, the hope would be that there is an imaginative glimpse at some other kind of reality that would help them retain not just something, some sort of escapism, but that would redefine their sense of reality for right now.
That's right. And that's the art, great art is an invitation to journey into that discovery process, and artists do not control that. you know, so each viewer has the opportunity on that moment to journey into something very uniquely crafted for that person. And as an artist, there's nothing more gratifying than people spending time journeying using my painting in a way to take off into that place. And it's very different from fantasy or, you know, this way of projecting something that is not real. It's really part of our journey into this greater reality with a capital R, you know, and so fantasy that is based on idol making.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's taking what is good and then turning it into something that you can control and you can worship.
That's what magic is.
That's what magic. Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. And so if this is the opposite, is to die to yourself, to take off that false mask of your ego, to encounter sometimes uncomfortable realities, and yet through that you end up on the other side, and you can grow in that experience.
So as we bring our conversation to a close, this seems like a good difficult but potentially practical way to bring our discussion into another kind of focus is in terms of, you said, died to yourself, and you've already mentioned your time with Shusaku Endo's silence and the great suffering in that.
Yes.
And for those of you that are listening that haven't had a chance to spend time with that, the gist of that is God's silence in the midst of great suffering in Japan.
Right.
And does God reveal himself to us even when he's silent?
Yes.
And so it strikes me that silence is something that, if we go with Endo, it's something that happens to us that we can either embrace, we can die to, and surrender to.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we come to your painting, it's something that we have to choose.
Yes.
So silence is, dying to self is either something that happens to us that we surrender to, or we can surrender in certain ascetic or if it's silence, literal silence or solitude.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that, what silence means to you practically?
Yeah, and it's interesting because silence is not lack of sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's lack of noise. Mm-hmm. And Endo kept on saying that, you know, his book is not about silence of God, but it's about the voice of God speaking through silence.
There you go. Thank you.
Which is a beautiful way. Yeah. I mean, he's a contrarian, you know. I mean, he agreed to a title called Silence, so, you know, he knew this will happen, right? But But in a sense, it's a wonderful dialectic there, because the reality is that we can inhabit that place without noise and create that for ourselves through our imagination and through our capacity to make. And all of us are makers, and all of us have a capacity to choose every single day. You know, people say, well, I'm not an artist. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, but you're a consumer. You know, you choose your iPod songs, and you know, and you choose your clothing every day. You get up in the morning. So all we have to really do is to learn to make in a way that, even as consumers, even as people who go to the supermarket and buy food, you know, we can be makers, right? I mean, we can go either to consume or we can go to make. Mm-hmm. Which one is it? If we were taking in something that was made by somebody else, we do it in gratitude so we can make something else. Mm-hmm. And that mindset shift, if we can do that, then it will help us to integrate ourselves in that journey of making. And silence is that place where that can happen. I think in some sense it can only happen without the noise that are constantly vying for attention. If in that space, whether it be a small desk of a poet or a studio or a kitchen or, you know, a garage, it's necessary for our being. Mm-hmm. For us to grow, for us to find that integration between the spirit and the body, and so that's what I have dedicated my life to as an artist. I will continue to hopefully help people to gain that space in their own lives, so that we can all rejoice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a Darwinian world in which somebody wins and somebody loses. Mm. Once you discover that zone, everybody wins. Mm. And it is amazing how a group of people who endeavor to find that still point, when it is a collaborative journey, how alive that community can become. So that is my desire. And I wrote Silence and Beauty as part of that journey, and hoping that the process will help others discover that.
So silence is a practical help to clarify which voices we're listening to.
Yes.
So the artist,
yes,
has to practice silence, or the mom,
yes,
who's trying to love,
yes,
her kids better.
That's right. That's right.
Because there's so much other noise.
Yes.
When I'm working in the prison. my poor language, but I came up with the definition of spiritual direction as a bullshit free zone.
Yes, yes, yes.
We're simply trying to cut out all the crap.
The mask comes off. Yeah.
So that we can hear the right reality.
That's the right reality. Yeah, in prison, some of the most beautiful letters were written out of prison, you know, the world, masterpieces. Mm-hmm. And so we need to listen to prisoners of this time and allow them to. We need to listen to prisoners, of our time, and allow them to speak into our souls. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they hear things that we can't hear.
So much of what we're talking about is,
yes,
is right out of the four quartets.
Yes.
Do you have the still point you mentioned?
Yes.
You know, the silence. Do you have a favorite passage?
Well, I always go to the end.
Yeah.
Of course, that's the most famous line, but I think that's...
Would you mind reading
as
we finish up?
Yes, absolutely.
Something that means a lot to you from T.S. Eliot.
Four quartets has to be read out loud, because it is literally in response. Eliot was recovering from trauma, and he heard the bombing going off as an air warden. And it was trying to mediate and get beyond that experience by listening to Beethoven's late quartets. And so that's echoed in the reading. And I remember after 9/11 reading this poem out loud in the subways of New York City, and nobody cared, you know, this is New York. And but I needed to hear the rhythm of these words. I'll read the last passage. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known, because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one.
Makoto Fujimura, thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. So what I hear at the end of this conversation with Makoto is this returning to the question of belonging to myself. This is the vocabulary that I had mapped in my previous episode with Christy Hepp. This is what we're trying to identify when it comes to silence. Notice what Makoto has explained about silence. It's our capacity to find an inner stillness away from the noise of all the false voices. So it might not be absolute silence, but we might need a painting, a walk in nature, a poem, or a song to regulate, to help calm ourselves enough to hear the competing voices, and then to discern which is our most true, loving voice. That's what it means to be okay with myself. To belong to myself is to navigate between all of the false voices, to notice the most loving, the true, the authentic voice. Then I also want to draw your attention to the role of the imagination in this process. And here I especially want to name this as both a personal and also a very public and political question. I love that early in this conversation, when Makoto considered which voice in our culture might seem too unrealistic, too fantastic to take seriously, he thought of Dr. King in his I Have a Dream speech. So many of the voices in our culture today are projecting doom. There are many reasons to despair. And in the face of this darkness, the invitation of the Holy Spirit is to a profoundly subversive act of hope. Is my life stuck? Has my vision of who I am dim and limited? These personal
questions of what I imagine for myself have their counterpart in what I imagine for my family, for my community, for my country. One mode of the arts is to help us dream new dreams. What Makoto Fujimura has offered us is a chance to rediscover what it means to be human, to be people who have generativity, that is our creativity to be able to give and not just consume and take. Amen. Thank you for joining in this conversation. It is good to have you on this journey with us. If you have any questions or thoughts you'd like to engage me, you can find me at josh@theinvitationcenter.org. And the time is coming for us to begin recruiting again for the School of Prayer and the School of Contemplative Listening. Those are our two formation programs. If you have interest in these things, please check them out at our website, theinvitationcenter.org, underneath the formation tab. If this podcast and any of our formation resources have been helpful to you, the most important way that you can support what we're doing is to continue to get the word out, to tell people about what we're doing. So much of the trouble of getting this episode and this series of conversations that I'm pulling off the shelf is the reality that the invitation is continuing to substantially come together as an organization that can not just be sustained, but also flourish. So if you have the means to offer some financial support, you can find your way again to theinvitationcenter.org. At the top right, you'll see a button that says Partner With Us. We are a 501c3 charitable organization, so your donations are tax deductible. And once again, we're thankful that you would join us on this learning journey, that you would find ways to become less, and that as you become less, you would open more freely to become dependent upon the giving and the receiving of God's love. Amen.